Park Place Meeting, Thursday afternoon, 17th June, 1976.
Yeah. Yesterday when you spoke about meditation.
Yes.
And the 8 angers, under Niyama, you didn't say anything about tapas, and I mentioned this to you, and you thought it was a good point.
Yeah.
The word tapas is translated usually as heat or as austerity. In the religious context, what brings about this heat? This austerity. It is the act, the process of being intensely attentive. Intense attentiveness generates psychical heat to start with, which may also manifest as the rise of temperature physically. It may do. But the important part is that when the attention begins to glow, the mind is warm, hot. It is an austerity, actually. It functions in terms essentially of removing all those aspects of belief or ideas or any fixations, any vasanas, the residua consisting of unworked out impressions in the well of the unconscious, and it burns them up. Think of Moses and the burning bush, for instance. There is something like that implied there. And then only the voice of God speaks out. Similarly, the yogi, the religious, who is in this intense inner attentiveness, warms up. As the tapas hots up, the austerity part means that he is released from the burden of past impressions and so forth. So, in the context of religious discipline, it is best to remember tapas as attentiveness first and foremost, and then as warmth and austerity. The austerity, which is the ascesis, the asceticism, which removes all that clogs the mind. We have an associated sound in modern Indian languages, tapas, meaning to examine. You see? And the tapasin is one who examines. Well, you can't examine without due attentiveness. If you look at it that way, if you study several of the hymns of the Rig Veda, where the word tapas comes in, you'll find it much better. You'll much more sense if you regard tapas as attention.
Would that account for a build-up of heat within us when we sit here and listen to you? There is a stifling feeling, an irritation of the throat, and a build-up of heat.
It could do, but that may be due to the fact that we are sitting in a room and several people around. Well, the temperature of the room does go up,
yeah.
You see? Also, there is the accumulation of carbon dioxide, which brings about some of those effects. On the other hand, if something grips your attention tremendously, undoubtedly you'll get warmed up by it.
That's extraordinary. I was listening to a thief on television telling you about the moment he's in the house, thieving, perspiring terribly, he said, full of a nervous sort of energy to get out quickly. So he feels heat as well.
Yes, well, does that perspiring afterwards leave him cold?
I don't know.
Nothing up for help.
This attentiveness that you were talking about, you know, in the tapas, is it anything to do with when Milarepa was, you know, went to Marpa for his, for he wanted the, you know, to have the teachings passed on to him, and he made him build these houses, and each time he had to pull them down. Was it because he hadn't paid sufficient attention, or was it something, I mean, there must be something very symbolic that perhaps we don't understand in that.
I have read that, of course, in the book on Milarepa by Evans-Wentz. Mm-hmm. Evans-Wentz talks about it. I haven't examined it very carefully, so I really don't know the answer there. Anybody knows the answer there? Betty, do you?
I think Milarepa had not worked out at that moment. His bad karma was sending the hail against the villagers who had wronged his mother. And Marpa made him pay every penny before he gave him the teachings in the shape of pulling the houses down again.
We were talking yesterday about the family being the true basis of society. And it seems to me that everything in this country today seems to be breaking that down and pointing to the individual. How can people ever get back to the idea of the family?
I don't know. Partly, it's very largely, I suppose, a question of upbringing. After all, the parents have to look after the children. If there is the perfect relationship of love and trust between parents and children, the family sense will be strengthened. Children and parents will think will feel and be conscious in terms of us and not about myself. There comes the time when, as the child becomes an adult, especially from puberty onwards, the sense of separate individuality grows, which is quite right. It should. Because if that doesn't grow, he or she, the child, will just become dependent upon the parent altogether. Will not be an asset to the family in the full and free sense. From after the period of dependence, there must grow the sense of non-dependence. But the non-dependence if it is right non-dependence, does not mean a breaking of the relationship of child and parent. What people do nowadays is to break a living relationship because they want to be independent, as they call it. In other words, to do what they like and as they like, which implies a considerable degree of inconsiderateness, of egoism, of self-assertiveness, and so on. This is unconducive to the healthy and harmonious growth of all parties concerned. See, non-dependence does not mean the breaking of a relationship or being inconsiderate of those with whom we had a relationship. Because after all, no one in the world can deny nature's fact that so-and-so is my father and so-and-so is my mother. That's nature's fact. Once it has happened, one cannot deny it. And if that is the fact, this relationship is a real live relationship right to the end of the life of one or other of the parties concerned. So how to restore that sense of family relationship? I should imagine it's a question of upbringing. And it's a question of actually living in love and freedom. But the freedom which is not license. I do what I like. This is where the educative part of upbringing comes in. I like this, I like that, yes. But we have so to live ourselves and so to bring up the children that the children and we too learn very really that man cannot live by this whimsical I like, I want, and I must have, or I shall go and get somehow. See, this is what produces all the upsy-downsiness of the whole situation.
The education has to be done early, though, because there comes, I think, a point of no return where communication, it's too late to communicate, and this is where the break comes.
Absolutely right.
If the communication comes early, then it sees the family through these difficult times, possibly, and sort of hold the child, as it were, without the dependence.
Sean, as far as one can see, certainly one of the factors in this, what I call a growing generation gap, there always has been a generation gap, it must be the revolt against of children, the revolt against being made into an image of their parents. Mm. And there's so much of this, there hasn't. I've seen it.
This is why, where there is real love, there is no compulsion. I remember so well my father. I have always said that in him I experienced the reality of underneath are the everlasting arms. He was kindness itself. He never even said a harsh word to me all through his life, you see. He would advise me, he'd say, well, son, if you do that, I'm afraid you'll find such and such difficulties, you see. And of course, son being very positive and very conceited and full of his own rightness, went and did it. then there'd be the pieces. And father would say, come along son, we'll put it right now, we'll put it right together. Son took a long time to learn, let me assure you. He saw all this only when he left the parental home and came to England. And then he, having been compelled to face life as it was in the raw, without the background of home and parents, then he began to remember what his father did for him and how he behaved. And he learned the lesson. At least I hope he did. That's a very good point you raised, Joan. There is a point of no return, and one has to be extraordinarily sensitive, extraordinarily perceptive, and one has to have at one's command, immediate command, the skill to do it in the right way. One doesn't do anything in the same way again and again. The circumstance is different. The children and ourselves have changed in the meanwhile. So the new skill in means. The skill in means is a growing thing all the time.
I think it's the parable of the lost son. And also, how parents can forgive their children of the most awful things, because blood, as we have a whole cliche, blood is thicker than water. And it's surprising what we forgive our own, we wouldn't forgive others. So I'm not so sure there isn't a point of no return.
So there is...
I don't know whether you said there wasn't a point of no return.
Yes, I think what Joan meant was that if one does not succeed in doing the right thing all along the line, you see, and lets things slide, there comes a time when you can't retrieve the situation. The parent cannot retrieve the situation. That's what you meant.
Yes, I was saying so too, that I remember a doctor friend of ours who giving his daughter advice about her children. He said, whatever happens with your family, always remember to keep the lines of communication open, no matter what happens. I think that's it.
Yeah.
Do you think this is perhaps what Jung meant when he talked about the principle of individuation, the puberty time, when they're supposed to sort of... That is the danger age. It should have been all done before then.
I haven't studied Jung that way. I don't know.
When you're evolving to be non-dependent, I think it means.
You want the answer to that one, read Integration of the Personality.
I have read it.
When you spoke this morning about activity instead of, we chose activity instead of fresh creation, is that, does that mean to get into a kind of formula of living like a child would do?
I'm sorry, Pat, I can't hear. You must speak very loudly.
You spoke of activity, we choose activity instead of fresh creation. Morning. I wrote the words down as you said them, and I wondered if it meant, I wasn't sure what you meant at the time, if you meant thinking in the formula to which we were accustomed, or a new creative way of thinking, a fresh way of thinking.
What did you say before you said the word activity?
Yes, you said, we take activity instead of fresh creation.
If what I said were precisely those words, I'm afraid I didn't speak sense. We take activity instead of fresh creation.
Could it be a sort of mechanical activity you're speaking of, a
subject, you'll have it on the tape. That's the answer. Surely you were talking about the Kabbalah. What went previously? How did
it was the second book after the Kabbalah. Yeah.
The second half.
Yes, the second half.
Yeah.
I think for us it created transcendence, make it more complicated.
When you play that tape back, you'll know exactly what the sentence was in connection with the quote, and then you can answer that.
Did you say to choose activity instead of creativity?
Perhaps, if I'm remembering correctly, perhaps what I intended to convey was something like this, that we indulge in repetitive action, just acting in the same way as before. Instead of letting action be the fresh new expression of the immediate perception. Sometimes it's very difficult just to take one little sentence out of the context. I just can't recollect. I have no idea at all what I said before or what I said after that. If I could get those also, then... And please do remember that in these talks, when one talks spontaneously all the time, it's easy to make slips of language. When I listen back to my own tapes sometimes, because I have to listen to them when making records for others, I'm amazed at the mistakes I've made.
What did you mean exactly by the words ancient wisdom? Because you said that there were two ancient wisdoms, one coming from the Veda, the other coming from the Kabbalah.
Two main expressions of the ancient wisdom. One was in the form of the Kabbalah, the other was in the form of the Veda, the original Veda and the original Kabbalah, and both were transmitted orally only. The writing down takes place centuries, millennia after their origination. You see, somewhere between the lands of the Fertile Crescent and up to the Hindu Kush and northwestern Himalayan range, somewhere in that region, and probably including Egypt too, this ancient wisdom, the esoteric wisdom, the knowledge of the reality of transcendence, its universality and all the rest of it, and the way in which the individual grows in such a way that with his purification and with his own quietening, this thing which they realized now and again as transcendence began to function continuously and permanently through them. See, this was the ancient wisdom and the discipline, the ways to it. And this ancient wisdom included something of supreme importance, which today people are just beginning to see. They understood human nature, the holy ones understood human nature completely and perfectly. Now there are the two aspects of understanding involved here. Two fields of understanding. One field is the ordinary person, my mind as it is, which is an imperfect and an impure mind, and in the ill state. They understood that fully. And they also knew what was implied by the perfected, purified mind, the utterly pure mind, free of defilements. Now this type of mind was something extraordinarily rare, and is extraordinarily rare in the human race. Out of the 4,000 millions on the globe, it would be a super optimistic statement that there are 4,000, one in a million, with such minds existing today. There may be about 400 at best, really. That's one in 10 millions, you see. Now they knew this perfected mind. It is one of the great significances, and a very important significance, of that statement that after the Enlightenment, the Buddha stood 7 days staring at the roots of the tree of enlightenment. But the tree of enlightenment is this, within your own body. The brain, the nervous system, the spinal cord, and all the psyche, all the whole of the psyche, of which this is the physical foundation. You see? They understood that this was something new, a totally new phenomenon, the utterly purified mind. How did the purified mind function? They knew that. They knew, in other words, the truly healthy, the truly mature mind. So they knew everything about the human mind. And remember that this utterly purified mind had gone all the way that is possible for the human race. Constituted as it is now, if and when the human race, the constitution of men and women changes and something new emerges, physically, it will be the root. It will make a very great difference to our whole sense of transcendence, all our faculties and all the rest of it. See? So as far as the human race as it is at present is constituted was concerned, they knew all about human nature. And this is something of extraordinary importance and value. So this was part of the ancient wisdom. It was part of it.
And Jesus Christ read nearly all of it.
All the great teachers. You will...
Who were these ancients?
I beg your pardon?
Who were these ancient wise people, and where did they get it from?
Look, there is one discourse in the Majjhima Nikaya, the middle length sayings, in which the Buddha gives a list of 108 names, or four names, 104, I think 104 names. I've got the volume upstairs, but I won't go up now. I'll show it to you later. 104 names of those who had realized Buddhahood. You see, he gives 104 names concerned with his particular age, maybe a couple of centuries or whatever the time period was. There are lists of names given at the end of the Brihadaranyaka Upanishad of the holy ones, you see. It's very interesting that in St. Luke's Gospel, I think, the genealogy of Jesus is traced right back to Adam, and the last sentence is, which was the Son of God. Adam, which was the Son of God. And this ending is identical with the ending in the Upanishad. So-and-so, 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 the son of so-and-so, who was the son of the self-existent Swayambhu. You see? Now, what is the significance of all this? Up to a point, there is a transmission from he who is the teacher to he who is the disciple. But the actual realization after that has to come from within. In the Kundalini Yoga, where they talk of the various chakras, the centers and so forth, when you come to the Ajna Chakra, the so-called sixth chakra between the eyebrows, they say that Ajna is the place where one hears the command of the Master. Now, it is in your own being. It's not out there. Your yoga teacher, whoever he may be, whether he be a perfected holy one or not, you see, stops short of that long before you arrive there. You see? So then, who were these perfected holy ones? You find lists of names like that. And where did they get their knowledge from? The ultimate source of knowledge was there, where the knowledge has transcended words altogether and conceptual thinking. The Vishuddhi chakra, the throat chakra, which deals with prophetic speech. And the prophetic speech is your own ability to formulate for yourself the profoundest insights that come to you, either through meditation or in any other way. They can come through your communing with nature, being in communing, in communion with nature. They can come through the operation of your senses when you are listening or looking at perfect art. Art which embodies transcendence itself. Not everything that passes as art, but the real thing, you see, it may come that way. And here speech ends, and there you're beyond conceptual thinking. See, there's a very good reason why in Buddhist yoga, the Ajna and the Sahasrara are usually regarded as a single crown center. And it's interesting that the term crown is used, like in the Kabbalah, they talk of the mystical crowns of the king, the various sephiroth. They are the mystical crowns of the king. You see? So this is the ancient wisdom. One can talk quite a lot about it, but I'd rather that you went on with questions.
Why is it that the Kabbalah is not used more in Western esoteric tradition? Is it purely esoteric, or can it be esoteric? We never hear about it in the church, and indeed a lot of higher level clergy don't seem to even have heard of it.
This kind of ignorance is not confined to the Judeo-Christian world, it's universal. All established religions where the clergy, I'm just using the term clergy for priests or monks or lamas or anything, they just join the order and so forth. Well, out of the thousands of members composing the clergy, most of them are just ignorant of these things. And you see, there are those who have a leaning, a natural intellectual leaning towards such things, but who themselves, because they are not freed of their conditioning, they are not free from the limitations imposed by their deep-seated biases, prejudices, preconceptions, and assumptions, will talk a lot about it misleadingly. So you see, it's a very, very difficult thing altogether. Only the few can know these things. And if, for instance, you read one of the really great works of the Kabbalah, the Zohar, and the word Zohar means book of splendor, you see, the book of splendor. If you read that work and you just read it in the literal sense, you will still scratch your head and say, well, what is this esoteric wisdom? It's all confusing and so forth. I don't understand it. You'll understand certain things, but a great many things you won't understand. I've looked through all the 5 volumes of the Zohar, and they are very difficult, believe me. You have to know a lot else in order to begin to make sense. And you must beware of trying to make sense purely as an intellectualist, as a logician. You must use the intellect, of course. You must be logical. You must have a sufficient core of logic which does not offend the minimum of logic demanded by intellect, you see. Because otherwise there won't be any cohesion in what you think or say. And therefore it will be just so much nonsense. But the rest has to be this extraordinary thing, which is insight, clear insight of the beyond formulation, and yet unformulated within yourself. It is when a person has that kind of development that he has, as we say so aptly in language, he has a sure touch upon these things. In the animal world, its expression is in terms of the phrase, his natural horse sense. Well, what is this horse sense? But what is what we call instinct in the animal flowers out into this transcendent, unerring insight. This is the real meaning of the word buddhi. When people translate buddhi as intuition, as a matter of fact, conventional scholars have translated buddhi as intellect. They are bad translations. Hitler had his intuitions. Where did they lead him? And in this connection, it is extremely useful to study one of the discourses of the Buddha, which is entitled, I don't know the exact words of the title, I'm sorry, I've forgotten, but it is he points out the difference between the good man and the bad man. And you'll be surprised to find that he doesn't talk about the bad man in terms of his badness. They both achieve the different stages, the jhanas and so forth, But when you come to the end of the story, you find a marvelous difference. The bad man is concerned with himself ultimately. He does all the grand things of the stages of meditation and development and attains the silas and samadhi and so forth. But when you come to the end, he is one who is grasping. The good man is one who is utterly free from grasping and utterly free from the restrictive I sense. He is not self-oriented. That's where the difference comes.
I suppose for us, looking around one, this is so obviously one of the pitfalls in the way. There are so, without going into names, there are so many people who set themselves up as teachers who've seen something, and because of exactly what you say, it's stopped and stuck and gone around and I am the master. And they're stuck there.
You're stuck with them, which is worse.
Thank you.
Would you say there were probably quite a number of Buddhas before the Buddha?
Perfected holy ones is a less restrictive term. The term Buddha has come to signify specifically something. You see, just in the same way, one may just as well inquire, there were several Christs before Jesus Christ and so forth. But you see, when we speak like that, we speak a little bit misleadingly. Not altogether.
Even if you say enlightened ones, would that be better?
Let me put it this way. Each human being who comes to full fruition as a human is unique and outstandingly original. Gautama the Buddha was outstandingly original in the way in which he presented the truth and represented in his own being the truth. So was Jesus Christ. So was Zarathustra. Spitama Zarathustra, that's the full title, you see. So was Sri Krishna. So were all the great teachers of the Upanishads and so forth, and those great saint seers who composed the hymns of the Rig Veda. You see, they are all original and unique. It is a little bit unfortunate that in the East they have talked in terms of so many previous Buddhas, the 24 Tirthankars of Jainism and all the rest of it. And as a matter of fact, in one of the discourses, the Buddha talks of those who taught before him, and they taught precisely the same thing. The same formulation comes out. You read it's the Mahapadana Sutta, the long discourses, one of the long discourses, you find it. But you know, that is an inadequate and a misleading way of presenting these things. If by Buddhahood you mean has realized wisdom, all right, but the form in which wisdom is realized is different for everybody, and the way it is expressed by that body. Otherwise one gets the impression that they are all rubber stamp copies, you know. All the angels in heaven are exactly 6 feet 6, and their wingspan is exactly that, and the color is exactly this, and so forth and so forth. The universe, creation, existence is not a machine. It is a living organism of the most extraordinary, unthinkable variety and richness. This is what makes its beauty, its marvel, its wonder, its awfulness in a sense, an awfulness which doesn't oppress and destroy you, but which fills you with that longing to just worship that which is the perfect and the marvelous. You see, and of course it is a thing of such power that it really draws you. And it draws you not by captivating you or enrapturing you or holding you in a prison house in any way. You are utterly free. This freedom is unthinkable and inexpressible, this freedom of the spirit. And it is associated, all this is associated with bliss. And the blissful state is the quiet state, the utterly silent state, vibrating like that, with an intensity and an immensity with which your discriminative consciousness, your imagination cannot keep pace.
Does physics know anything about this vibration today?
Physics knows all about vibrating.
No, this particular one.
This is a different matter. It's not the realm of exploration by physics. We must always realize that each of the great branches of knowledge and culture which the human race has brought into being has its own specific context. Science is the context of the approach and the discovery of reality through understanding the nature of things, through understanding the nature of the concrete experience and expression. I should have said expression first, the concrete expression and experience of reality. And that is approached in terms of the human consciousness functioning through the medium of the use of the senses and the brain and logic. You see, we must understand clearly that that is the scientific approach. And the scientific approach gives us a valid testament of reality for us in this state of awareness. But you and I are capable not only of this state of awareness, but also of the transcendent awareness. And then we make the statement which is the statement of mysticism. And that is also a completely valid testament of reality, of truth. The great creative artists gave their completely valid testament of reality. The great composers, the great poets, the great architects and sculptors and painters and so on, they gave their testament of reality. In everyday life, whatsoever you do, insofar as it is done with perfection, with selflessness, with spontaneity, that is a valid testament of reality. If your cook cooks in that way, he or she is presenting a testament of the supreme reality. So you see, when a person says, oh well, these wonderful transcendent things, you know, I'm not that sort, I haven't got the abilities and so on. All right, can you make the perfect cake? Oh yes. Can you mold clay and make something which is absolutely wonderful? Yes, that's your testament. That is your realization of ultimate reality. You see, you take away drudgery and all that to an immense degree if you really understand this. But you must understand it, not just take it as a thought, as a consolatory doctrine emanating from P.M. Esquire.
There's a very interesting book recently brought out in Sirius called Zen and the Art of the Motorcycle Maintenance, which is right exactly what you've been saying. A man talking from his own personal experience of Zen in action in life.
Zen in action.
Action in life, yes.
Mm. Maurice, you must have got my message, but it was something else I was trying to send you. I wondered whether you could perhaps put something. I was going to ask whether that has helped you over the difficulties you were talking about yesterday to me, if you remember. I came back in the evening.
It should have done,
but it didn't. Would it be too painful for you to put that to Perot, and perhaps he could throw a little more light on me? Because it's something that happens to all of us. It doesn't only happen to you. But if you can't.
Mm. Well, I told you briefly, Perot, about the experience funeral that I went to on Wednesday. Can you hear me?
Yes, yes, just.
And I told you a little about the circumstances. And it seemed to me that this was an emotional experience, a deep personal experience by the people concerned, in which nothing I could say and nothing that anybody could say could help them in any sense at all, in any valid sense at all. I wondered how what you had to say about this kind of situation where the people concerned are quite incapable of being, apparently, of being reached by any consolation.
If you can remain quite quiet within yourself, completely attentive to that person and his sorrow or difficulty or whatever it was, you see, absorb that in your own being, then your own being becomes a focus through which the streams of transcendent compassion flow through and affect the situation. I don't know how it would affect it and so on. One can't see it, at least I can't, you see. But I believe this is the sort of way in which karuna, the real karuna, compassion in the real sense, functions. But you see, it entails this capacity to be perfectly poised and still within oneself. Otherwise, what functions, what could function, is your own thoughts and feelings of sympathy, of suffering with the other person's suffering. But if I suffer, or if you suffer with the other person's suffering, in a manner which causes upset within yourself, then there is a flaw, a hitch in the process. These are the great difficulties. Recall, for instance, that marvelous story of the mother who had lost her son, her baby died. She came to the Buddha and wanted the cure, you see, to bring the baby back to life. You know the whole story. Bring a grain of mustard seed, but from the house where no death has taken place. Now, can you, I'm sure you can, you have the knowledge, the imagination, picture what was the state of the Buddha. There is this mother, distraught, in distress, with her child dead in her arms. She comes to one who is so peaceful, so quiet, so established permanently in the sunyata phala samadhi, that state of communion which is the fruit of the void, who is so established in that. And he, remember, knows the perfected mind, he also knows the imperfect mind. So his his sympathy is not like my sympathy, something which is associated with upset within myself. His sympathy is the sympathy of the one in whom there is the eternal peace established. That is the person through whom the streams of compassion flow out. He tells Kesa Gotami what to do, and he knows that by the time she has finished her quest, she will have understood. His attention is concentrated upon her. This is how Karuna functions. These four Brahma Viharas are something extraordinarily profound. We haven't begun to understand what they are and how they function, and at what level they function, where they have their origins. So you see, it's something like that. So all we can do is to do our best to maintain as great a poise as possible.
One of the things that happens in a situation like this, and I saw it in myself at the funeral, which was a terribly emotional affair altogether. I don't know whether everybody knows, it was a 19-year-old girl that was killed quite suddenly last week, an only daughter. And I think part of it that inhibits you from feeling true compassion is guilt. Because I found myself identifying, of course, with the mother, but also there was a sort of horrible sort of a lot of horrific fascination about the whole thing. You know, I wanted to see her face. You know, she looked, as Morris says, stricken, that was the word he used, and she was stricken, and one got a sort of twisty pleasure out of it, if that's the right way to say. You know, you felt a sort of all sorts of things coming up in you, as though you had to sort of look at her, you had to, I'm not sure that it was confused, you said, no joy so great as when friend falls off root. You know, this sort of thing. There is something there where there is trouble and somebody else is suffering, that you have a sort of little bit of perverted enjoyment. And I think in any circumstance like this, this sort of thing comes up to you and stops. And it's the guilty feeling about that stops a lot of your real compassion coming